ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about the delay there. Had Skype crash unexpectedly for no reason. Happens all the time, apparently. Thank you, Microsoft. You're the Shiite Muslim. Today on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about one of the main issues affecting virtually every single person around the entire freaking planet. It's called debt. All right? And there's a gosh awful dang bunch of really, really nasty, poisonous, infectious, ruthless spiders that are in the middle of this web that we're all trapped in, so that we're all wrapped up in debt so that the spider can eat at its leisure and liquefy our insides, that's why they call it liquidity, and slurp it all out through your wallet. And my very special guest to illustrate on this is none other than the author of The Web of Debt, Alan Brown. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vince.
I hope you're enjoying yourself so far.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, can you please explain what debt actually is in the first place, how it's created, and more to the point, how it's kept going all this time?
Well, the problem with our monetary system is that all of our money, virtually all of our money, is created in the form of debt. It's created by banks when they make loans. Most people think that money is created by the government because you look at the coins and the dollar bills and you see pictures of presidents and queens and prime ministers. But in fact, coins and dollar bills make up only a very small part of the money supply, and even the dollar bills or the banknotes, whatever they're called, are generally issued by the central bank and lent to the government. They're not actually issued by the government itself. And the money that we, the people, trade in is virtually all of it consists of entries, book entries done by banks when they make loans. So if you go to the bank and you take out a mortgage, let's say, they will write your mortgage on one side of their books as an asset to themselves because you have promised to pay that sum over time. And they will write it as a liability to themselves on the other side of their books because they have agreed to cover your checks when you write checks on that account that they've just opened for you. So from their point of view, it all comes out to zero and they haven't really created anything. But those checks that you write that go out into the economy, that becomes our money supply. And that's how the money supply expands and expands. But the problem is that when they create the principal of these loans, they don't create the interest. And so more money is always owed back than was created in the original loan. And there's no place to get that extra money except for somebody to take out more debt. And so it's the nature of a debt-based system that it's like a parasite. It has to continually grow. It grows in this exponential curve in order to find the money to pay principal plus interest when only principal was created in the original loan. So today what we have is everybody's in debt. The people, corporations, governments, they're all in debt. So who are they in debt to? They're not in debt to each other. They're in debt to banks. And the way to fix the system is we really have to fix the banking system by making it sustainable, which would mean that the profits, the interest goes back to the people so that the money's there in order to keep up this cycle of credit creation.
Sustainable, but not in the Agenda 21 sense of the word.
No.
Well, thank goodness for that. Because this is another thing that I've also wondered about, Alan. They're capable of creating all this debt, but people aren't capable of paying it forever. It's like musical chairs. One person is going to end up with the last remaining chair. And that will be the one who creates all the debt at the very central level. Who is that? What is that entity?
That's a good question. Who's behind it all? In fact, you could argue that the system is running itself today, but it was obviously set up, this whole debt-based system. Paper money came into existence pretty much in the 17th century, but even before that, you had bankers would create... they would make more loans than they actually had had gold, and they did this as a bookkeeping entry. So you've had the creation of credit for 1,000 years. Well, in fact, you can go all the way back to biblical times. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say who's behind it or who would wind up with the money in the end. The Bank for International Settlements is the central banker's central bank, and that's in Basel, Switzerland, and that is, they call the shots pretty much, or the Financial Stability Board calls the shots, which is based in the Bank for International Settlements. And that system was originally set up by the Bank of England, which was trying to keep control of their colonies. After the colonies gained political independence, they controlled them by debt. And so they expected to be the central source of all the debt. And then after World War I, when they were unable to fund everything because of war debts themselves, then they spread out this central banking control to the Bank for International Settlements was originally founded by four bankers. It was the Bank of England, the head of the Bank of England, the head of the Central Bank of France, Central Bank of Germany, and the Central Bank of America, the U.S. Federal
this
Reserve.
Is not unlike, this isn't like European royalty, is it, where they're all related?
No. Well, depends. We don't want to get into that.
Well, you see, the reason I ask is because I was aware that after the Battle of Waterloo, was it Mayer L. Rothschild or one of them tipped the stock market over? Basically, he had a good intelligence network, and he knew the outcome of the battle a full day before the royals spies came home to tell them, and he used that knowledge, knowing that the British had won, that it would really boost the stock market. Played out like that, it would like they'd lost, and the stock market started to crash overnight, and he bought it all up for pennies on the dollar. Is that true? Mm-hmm. And then he created the Bank of England or something.
Yeah, that was Nathan Rothschild. Yeah, but the Bank of England was created in 1694. But yeah, that is the legend. It's presumably that happened. And they did become the most powerful family in England and probably the most powerful family in the world. There were five Rothschild brothers. There were 10 kids. Five of them were male, and they headed banks in different parts of Europe. And so that was the original network. And because they were this very tight network, they were able to exchange information very quickly. And so he did get a report on the war faster than anyone else could. And since then, of course, you could argue that the Rothschilds set up this whole system, but they're certainly not the only. There are many other families that are involved. So I'm not sure you can put your finger on
what anyone. What's the word for a system of government where the most powerful families rule? Is that a plutocracy?
I think so. A plutocracy. Yeah. What's an oligarchy? That's when there's several.
I thought oligarchy was simply ruled by money.
Yeah, okay.
Whoever had the money makes the rules, the golden rule.
Yeah.
I believe, in fact, we've got a kind of combination, a plutocracy and an oligarchy, I think, is what we've really got now, is we've got incredibly wealthy people who just happen to be related and just happen to be sociopathic scum who want to control everything.
Yeah, it is hard to believe. I mean, I'm just now, I thought I would sort of break out of my mold and write about GMOs and the Roundup, you know, the chemical that this is actually killing the earth. It's hard to believe that, I mean, what kind of a personality would allow into the earth on which we all live? And yet, that's definitely happening. The chemical in Roundup blocks enzymes from working, which means that it kills every form of plant. So then you need to develop genetically modified plants that are able to survive in Roundup. So they're Roundup resistant plants, and that's what the genetic modification is. But that doesn't mean that you've gotten rid of the Roundup. They actually incorporate it into their roots and into the plant. So when you eat that plant, you are eating pesticide that will block your enzymes, prevent you from digesting your food, which means you're not getting your nutrition, which could well explain why we have an epidemic of obesity and many other diseases that are going up. When, like, we've had the war against cancer since the 1970s, and yet cancer has multiplied by several factors since then, rather than going down. Why is that? There's something in our food, something in our environment, and it's all the mentality of somebody who would want to do that in order to control food sources is, I mean, it hardly seems human, and yet we know it's happening.
Well, thank goodness you don't live in New Zealand. We're allowed 1,000 times more Roundup in our drinking water than allowed under European drinking water standards. And we have the world's highest cancer rate, I think.
Wow.
It's like one in two now.
I'll look into that, yeah. Well, they just increased the allowable rate by a factor of 30.
Oh, of course they did.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Well, that's what happens. It's like things get introduced, they make things worse, and instead of going, "Oh, this is making things worse," like a moral person, a person who believes in truth, justice, that kind of thing, would say, "That's really bad. Let's remove that." An amoral person would probably introduce it in the first place. But once you see the results, then they try to cover up the results or increase the levels of allowable toxins and poisons in the environment. And it goes contrary to any form of logic and morality. Now, what I find interesting and also most disturbing, to be frank, is that people go along with it. That's what's worse to me than knowing that there are immoral people out there who have large quantities of power and control, who literally are advancing an agenda to indebt, enslave, and kill humanity to a large degree. There's the good people who sit by and do nothing. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Ellen Brown. I think it's webofdebt.com. Is that right?
Yep, that'll do. One of many.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and technical difficulties, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. Speaking of technical difficulties, our guest, Ellen Brown, has been disconnected, and we don't know when we'll be getting her back, hopefully soon. We're having a conversation over the break, and I don't know if it surprised you, ladies and gentlemen, but it surprised me to hear her talking about glyphosate, Roundup, Monsatan, which in French means my devil. And the thing that she revealed to me over the break is that before actually writing Web of Debt, which is the banking bible kind of thing, if you want to expose the Bank of International Settlements and their enormous scumbaggery, she's actually written like 11 health books. Now, really? And I was quite surprised to hear that, but, you know, today we're probably going to hopefully focus on the banking because I think, but then again, what's more important, banking and exposing its scumbaggery or health? And I think they're both really important. It's kind of like when people talk about the left brain and the right brain, and people say, oh, the left brain's more important or the right brain's more important. No, you idiot. Having your whole brain working is more important.
Mm-hmm.
Just like having a holistic idea of what health is and what banking is at the same time is a hell of a lot more important than just knowing the one. And this is something that Ellen knows quite a lot about. Yeah, and I hear that you're back. Are you able to turn your webcam on there?
I'm back.
Okay,
good.
Do you
see me? Do you hear me?
I can hear you, but I cannot see you just see yet.
Yep, you just reset the
camera. Should be now. Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, in the meantime, when we think about banking, what I find interesting is that often the leaders of countries are either bankers themselves or heavily financed by bankers. And I found that very startling and kind of scary, but also pretty obvious, and it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because if you're going to make policy to shaft a country, who better to have as your president than a banker? You know, it's pretty straightforward, I would have thought.
Well, in Europe right now, we have bankers that are heading the system that were not elected as presidents. I mean, the head of Greece. Well, sorry, I'll take that back. But anyway, we have
is this Mr. Papademos in Greece
controlling the economic system? Yeah. And I mean, the whole European system simply is not sustainable because the ECB, it's set up so that only banks can get money from the ECB. The governments themselves cannot borrow from the ECB, which is the central bank of Europe. And so the governments have to borrow from the banks, which then borrow from the ECB. So the banker's rates, the good deal that you get as a banker only goes to the bankers, and then they pass it on to the governments at much, much higher rates. Unlike in the U.S., where at least our central bank can fund the government. I mean, it can buy government bonds, which is what they are doing with quantitative easing, which many people think is controversial or think is inflating the system, but it's not actually. It's just an asset swap where they're buying up bonds, and so the banks that used to have bonds on their books now have dollars on their books, and the Federal Reserve has the bonds. But the difference is that when the Federal Reserve gets the bonds, they rebate the interest to the government. So effectively, our government, to the extent that the Federal Reserve is holding our government's bonds, our government is borrowing interest-free from its own central bank, which is a good thing. That's what Canada did from 1939 to 1974. And during that time, they funded their development all across the country. They funded their health, set up their healthcare system, and that's how they funded it. And it wasn't in the 1970s, they switched over to borrowing on the open market, borrowing from banks and other lenders, which meant they were borrowing at a much higher interest rate. Or when they were borrowing from themselves, they were effectively borrowing interest-free. And then you're in Australia. Let's see, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia.
I'm in New Zealand.
I'm sorry, okay.
The Reserve Bank of New Zealand.
So the Reserve Bank of New Zealand in the 1930s did the same thing. It was set up as a central bank that was supposed to be privately owned, like the U.S. Federal Reserve is privately owned. And the Social Credit Party got in, or a Money Reform Party got in, and took it over and used it as an instrument of social credit. So what they did was just issue credit, the credit of the government through the central bank. And one thing they did was set up this low-cost housing, for public housing. And they built it with public credit, and then the rent from this housing paid off the loan. Just that was the same way that Roosevelt funded the whole New Deal, where you advance credit for things that are productive enterprises, things like roads and dams and farms and libraries and post offices and universities, things where the loan was then paid back, and you wound up with infrastructure. And it was basically the taxpayers didn't have to pay anything. But the trick is you have to be able to extend the credit in the first place. So anyway, that's what a central bank should do, and that's what New Zealand has done, Australia has done historically. Australia was the best, the most remarkable of the models. In 1912, what the U.S. Federal Reserve was set up in 1913, but at that period in 1912, there had been a global banking crisis, and the Australians felt that the banks had failed and that the government needed to take over this function. And so they set up their own publicly owned central bank. And then the man who headed it, who was a banker and knew that banks just issued credit from nothing, that knew that they got the money just as accounting entries, he just started issuing credit for all sorts of development across the country and for funding Australia's participation in World War One. So his downfall was when he went to London and bragged about the fact that they didn't need to borrow anymore. They no longer needed to borrow from the City of London, that anything the Australians wanted they could have. They just had to issue the credit, and then if they made prudent loans, the credit would pay for itself over time. And so he passed away suddenly after that of a heart attack at a relatively young age, 63. And after that, they changed the system where they set up this central bank system where the central bank would issue the money and lend it to the government. And now they got so excited about this system, they decided they would do that globally. And that's what we have today, is this global central banking system controlled by Basel, by the Financial Stability Board at the Bank for International Settlements, yeah, in Basel, which stemmed originally from the Bank of England or from the City of London.
So not only is there connections between the setting ups of all banks, I was just starting to think now, how many people, is there a web page somewhere where somebody has listed all the public figures that have stood up against private central money lending, debt-based banking, and how many of them have been killed over time?
Not to my knowledge, but I could name a few. You probably can too.
I mean, the first one that comes to mind is like Jesus. he threw the money changers out of the temple. Okay. Ah, crucifixion.
Yeah, good point.
Crucifixion? Yes, good. Line on the left, grab a cross, one cross each. Mm-hmm. If that does actually happen, whoa, does that mean bankers need to be executed, right? Because George Carlin actually said this in one of his comedy routines, and I think it bears repeating, that there are some people out there who want to legalize the death penalty for drug dealers. And he says this is a waste of time because drug dealers aren't afraid to die. They kill each other by the hundreds every day. If you want to stop the drug money, why not execute the bankers who launder it? White, middle-class, Republican bankers,
on pay-per-view. Well, it's true. It would, it'd be satisfying to see, everybody wants to see the crooks go to jail, but you have to fix the system, or it's like ants or termites or whatever. I mean, cockroaches, you get rid of one, and five more fill in that, are right behind them. And until you plug the holes where they come in. So it seems to me that our ultimate goal has to be to restructure the system. There will always be people ready to take advantage of opportunities. Like the whole Wall Street syndrome, the movie Wall Street was set up to discourage young people from going into the trading business. And in fact, what it did was everybody then wanted to be a trader. They like this idea of cheating the system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's when you give people the opportunity for great rewards with bugger all work, they jump on the opportunity, don't they? I think that's why government employs so many people. And Texas, so many others.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. You could eliminate taxes. You could entirely eliminate taxes. They did it in colonial America, in Pennsylvania, by if the government ran the banks. I actually ran the figures on this for, well, what they did in Pennsylvania was the government had the printing press. It printed its own paper money. But instead of just printing and printing and printing, which did tend to hyperinflate the system, you know, some other colonies got into inflation problems. But in Pennsylvania, what they did was they printed money and lent it to the farmers. And then the money would come back with principal plus 5% interest. But then they spent some extra money into the for roads and bridges and whatever their budget was. So there would be enough money out there to pay principal and interest. So it would all come back to the government as principal and interest. So this is the public banking model where it's sustainable. Instead of having to take out more and more debt to pay the interest, the interest is out there and it can come back. And so during that period, they paid no taxes because the money made by the bank itself was sufficient to cover taxes. And had no government debt, and they didn't have inflation. So it was a totally sustainable.
Sorry? There's been suggestions that a good idea is to both outlaw charging interest and outlaw taxes. Unapportioned taxes, rather, income tax specifically.
Right. You could eliminate income taxes. That's right. You might not be able to eliminate all taxes. But the way I figured it a few years ago, I think there was something $400 billion that we pay in taxes. I was calculating the whole budget, which... Okay, so I think it was $1.2 trillion was taxes, $400 billion was interest on the federal debt. And then the banks themselves made $700 billion in interest. So if you add those two things together, if you didn't have to pay interest on your debt because you own the bank, and if you were the bank and therefore you got the interest that everybody else paid on their loans, that would be sufficient to cover the entire income tax bill. So you could wipe out income taxes that way. I personally am not opposed to interest if the bank is we the people. In other words, interest is, you actually need interest for a sustainable system because some people won't pay back their loans. Even in the best intention people, there will be defaults. And so if you're going to balance your books, if that's a requirement that you balance your books, and if the default rate, in the best of times, the default rate, I think, is about 4%. So you would need to charge 4% interest just to cover that. And let's say you throw in a little more for your... Well, anyway, 4% interest would do it. But also, it seems to me there's a problem. If you're going to give interest-free loans to individuals, everybody will say, well, I have this brilliant idea. If I just had $1 million, I'd pay you back in a year. You know, lend me $1 million, I'll do my brilliant idea, and I'll pay you back with my profits. And then you almost make it, but you don't. And you say, well, I'll do it next year. You know, roll over my loan, and I'll do it next year. What incentive do you have to ever pay it off? You'll just keep rolling over the loan. Unless there is some interest, some reason to make it your benefit to pay it off.
All right. Well, let's continue this one over the break because I think it is very interesting indeed. Pun intended. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery banksters, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Ellen Brown. She's an author. Webofdebt.com is one of her websites. Something tells me you've got like umpteen others. Would you care to, give yourself a shameless plug?
Okay. Well, my latest book is called The Public Bank Solution, which is, so Web of Debt was the problem, which is the banking system. The solution is a better banking system, which would be one that's publicly owned, that returns the profits to the public, returns the interest, that has control of where credit is directed, so credit can go where in the sectors of the economy where it's needed. So that website is publicbanksolution.com. And then my blog is at ellenbrown.com, and it's got over 200 articles on it, on this subject. And I guess that's enough. Web of Debt. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
I also have a publishing company.
The public banking system has been opposed by many sides, and usually by people with no information who just choose to demonize people who promote this kind of banking system, which historically does actually work and work very well, and as you've said, is sustainable. One of the critiques that I've seen is they call it funny money. And I say, well, if public banking money is funny money, what we've got now is frickin' hilarious.
Well, public banking is not about changing the issue of the money. I mean, we're talking about local public banks. You could have central public banks, of course, that many central banks are technically owned by the government. For example, the Bank of England is owned by the government, but it's still controlled privately. I mean, it caters to the banks. Or the Federal Reserve is the obvious example. It is literally privately owned. There are 12 branches of the Federal Reserve System. All of them are 100% owned. The stock of the branches, they're incorporated. The stock of the branches is 100% owned by the banks in their districts. And they, of course, pull the strings. And the Federal Reserve Act itself is set up to serve the banks. In fact, when Ben Bernanke was doing quantitative easing, after he did the first quantitative easing, and then they were thinking about what to do on the second round of quantitative easing, and it was suggested that why didn't he issue money and lend it very cheaply to state and local governments, because they were the ones that had been devastated by this whole banking crisis, and it wasn't their fault. I mean, they had lost their tax base because of this banking crisis, which was the fault of Wall Street. So why not give them these bankers' rates, you know, these very low interest rates? And Ben Bernanke said, well, it's not in his mandate. That's not in the Federal Reserve Act. He is not allowed to make loans to state and local governments. And it's the same way with the ECB. It is not allowed, according to the Maastricht Treaty, to make loans directly to governments.
So basically, if you're a private central bank, it's illegal to actually help the government that you're supposed to be providing the money for.
Right. And at one time, central banks actually belonged to the governments and they served the governments. And that was a better system. I mean, you could corrupt any system. Well, I just now wrote about Costa Rica, which I don't think I wasn't even aware of it myself until somebody wrote to me who lives in Costa Rica. And he said they have this wonderful banking system. It's 80% publicly owned banks. The people refuse to give up their publicly owned banks, even though the IMF has tried very hard to privatize them. The whole system went, in 1949, there was a big revolution. And before that, they were the poorest, they were the poorest country around. And so they didn't have resources. They didn't really have anything. And they came around to now they were rated as the number one on the happiness index by, I forget who it is who does his ratings, but anyway, quality of life is very high in Costa Rica. And what they did was they turned a number of major industries into publicly owned industries. So they were making money for the people with these industries. These are like infrastructure, the type of industries that should be commonly owned, or should, you know, the profits should go back to the people, and they do. Telecommunications, they refuse to give that up. Social Security, pension funds, those are all in the public sector. And the public sector controls banks and or owns the banks. And so they're very safe for the people. In the rest of Central America, the banks keep failing, and then people lose their money when the banks fail. So that's why the people don't want to give up these public banks, which are very safe. They're protected by the government because they are the government. And they direct credit for 50 years now. They've been directing credit to the sectors that need it. So they've used that credit to build infrastructure, et cetera. And it's worked really well. So the man that wrote to me about that, he keeps telling me more and more about the system. He said that when people ask him, well, why do you think this worked so much better in Costa Rica than it did in Eastern Europe? Well, for one thing, he thinks it probably did work better in Eastern Europe than we've been led to believe or we're allowed to know. But that he thought that the difference was that in Costa Rica, it's a very democratic, transparent, accountable system. I mean, it's, if you have a corrupt government, of course, you can corrupt anything, including your banks. But if you have an accountable system where everybody can see what's going on, and we've now come to that stage where, because of the internet, it's quite possible that you could put your whole banking system on the internet, and people could see, like the Bank of North Dakota, which is publicly owned, they could see exactly what's going on, what kind of loans are being made, who they're being made to. So it would be fully accountable, fully transparent in a democratic system. Then it works really well.
It would allow a lot of public watchdogs the information they need in order to indeed force accountability by exposing any type of corruption that they might find. I remember I talked to the late Bob Chapman a number of years ago, and I asked him, is it possible to get rid of corruption, like entirely, forever? He says, no, it's not possible to get rid of corruption. It is possible to get it back, but it's a perennial problem. It's like grass. You have to keep mowing it down.
Yeah, but I just wonder, I mean, it seems to me that we are sort of, the internet has changed so many things. For example, the media can't control us anymore because we have our own media, so we can find out what's going on. And then this whole spying thing, I mean, it is creepy that they can know everything about you, but just imagine it, that we could actually turn that for good, it seems to me, possibly, in the sense that if you know that there's nowhere to hide, then you'll do the right thing, because why not? You might
what
as well.
What have you got to lose?
Yeah. It's just way too tempting to cheat when it's easy to cheat. But if it's not easy to cheat, then you'll play by the rules. Why not?
Yeah, I think so, because that's how corruption works, I think. People would do corrupt things if they can't get away with them.
It's like cockroaches. You get rid of all the places to hide and you won't have cockroaches.
Well, exactly. But, of course, you've got to remain eternally vigilant. And I think this is one of the what the Founding Fathers said, is that that's the price of freedom, is you've got to eternally live in vigilance to for your true enemy's return.
Yeah, true.
Mm. You know, freedom isn't free, and that's what people don't really get, because it's been handed to them on a silver platter all their lives. Hello, you've got freedom of speech, you've got freedom of this, that, and the other, but you don't actually have any of those rights that they say to you, because they just keep getting taken away by the corrupt system, right? You only actually have three rights, and this was told to me by a police prosecuting sergeant, 15 years in the New Zealand police. Put up, shut up, or pay up. Those are the only three rights guaranteed to you by the law and the legal system. Everything else, you have to fight and or die for.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. But I do think that one reason people are apathetic is they really don't feel they have any power. That, for example, nobody wants these wars that are going on in the Middle East. The public doesn't want them. But what can we do about it? They're not listening to us. We can call our Congress people. They don't listen. No matter what, we don't have the big law. It's the big lobbies that control everything. They're not listening to we the people. But I think that's the problem we have to overcome, is we have the numbers. If we could get organized, we need a united front of a movement to change things. And the problem there is that there are many money, I mean, even just in reforming money, and there are lots of things that need reform, but just say in banking, we have different theories just on that. And so people can't, or, we're at the stage now where we're sort of battling it out among ourselves about what is the best system to have. You could have a violent revolution, as many countries have had, but what they tend to lead to is military dictatorships, because everybody knows we don't like the current system, but there's no agreement on what we want to replace it with. So I think in order to do this sanely, civilly, and to come out with something better, we need to have a plan that we agree on before we attempt to change the system.
I completely agree. And there's a new age philosophy that if it's negative, I don't want to look at it. You know, if it's bad, I don't want to look at it. I want to ignore it. And what you resist persists. And it's the direct opposite to reality, because if you don't look at what the actual problem is openly, honestly, and you accept the problem for what it is, how in the frack are you ever going to propose a solution that actually solves those problems if you have no idea what the problems themselves actually are because you're too afraid to look at them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Be brave, ladies and gentlemen, and mighty forces will come to your aid. Alan Brown from webofdebt.com, thank you very much for your time today, love.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back next segment, ladies and gentlemen, with Dr. Richard Alan Miller. Stay tuned.